welcome to another episode of Latchkey Urchins
and Friends.
I'm Allison.
And I'm Ann Sherry.
And
you can say your last name.
Zabula. Onion.
Onion. Not garlic.
Onion. Yeah. Saboya.
There's this thing of IFS talk, they talk about it being more like where garlic cloves, that there's like these rather than onions. Because I've always struggled a little bit with the onion analogy. Because
sure.
The tears often are, if I peel and peel, then there is nothing, right? And that's our deepest fear, that if I go into my shit, I don't exist. So the garlic works better for me. Like these little cells, these little parts in a clove. So sorry.
I like the garlic clove, and that's very IFS.
That is very IFS.
Little pieces, little parts.
Little pieces.
Yeah. So, okay. So today we are doing an interview. We had recorded the interview already that we're going to play with Anne's husband, Tom Sherry, who I adore.
Yes, I do too. Most times. Actually, it took a little while. Relationships
are so
weird.
Hard to like, yes. especially to live with someone. How does anyone do it?
I mean, it's an insane proposition. Like insane.
It's right? Insane. It's insane.
Yeah. Like I'm going to just, you and I are going to be on this little fucking boat, this little island. And actually maybe that's, again, I generally look through the lens of, individualness. Remember I think Tom and I talk about this, having independent personality disorder. yeah. So anyways, I think most people probably look at, we used to be married in communities or whatever. It wasn't.
That's so true.
Yeah.
It but wasn't an individual choice. It was like, now the woman belongs to the man and will serve his household.
or the community, I guess. I don't know how this is all supposed to go. What I know is it's hard. And I also know as a therapist, I would never attempt to be a couples therapist. My hat goes off to people who attempt that. That's really hard dealing with the two systems. Yeah. And most people are coming to couples therapy after it's probably too late. Go early and go often. You're not supposed to be able to know how to do this stuff. So
it's so hard. Well, I have to say, like, your voice has gotten stuck in my head lately, you know, since we've been doing the podcast about being in relationship. Like, I can't stop thinking about what that means. Just not, I don't mean romantic. I mean, with your community, having a fucking community. Of like, there's people that you care about and they care about you and you show up and you fight for them and da, da, da. And it's, you've gotten in my head because I'm like, I don't think as Americans or Westerners, I don't know that any of us are doing this.
I guess they exist. I mean, it does, I guess. I joined a church, you know?
No, like, and I love church.
But I haven't been going. I know
there's a pandemic.
I know, but it's whatever. You got online church We keep trying. I mean, it's almost like this, it feels like this thing you keep stepping up to, but it's like, you don't really know how to like to actually be in the community.
Yeah.
You've got to learn to be vulnerable. You got to learn to be in conflict. And it's that piece that we've been talking
about.
Exactly. I'm so brittle around conflict and somebody getting better. It's life's work. But you aren't really shown that,
I
think our kid is getting better at it. He has no problem being in conflict with us, you know, but then there's this repair that happens.
That's nice.
It like kind of just happens. And it's like, you just stay in the game. So for relationships, that one of Tom's big things is, are you in the game? You know, people come to couples therapy.
Yeah.
And it's like, you've got to establish, like, I do want this to work. I mean, there's a funny phrase.
There's attachment issues though, that come up.
Yeah. Janice's book is really good around that. The Running on Empty No More. She really lays it out about what it is to come to a couple with all this attachment stuff and neglect pieces. Yeah.
But like, so it was my dad's birthday Friday and I went over and it was like, he has a lot of siblings, I feel like it's just trauma to have that many siblings. He's one of 10 kids. And yeah. And so my grandparents were there, his parents and a sibling of his and her spouse and a couple other people. And there was a lot of drinking. I feel like drinking is kind of a trauma response in my family, and not to criticize anyone. I just notice it. And I think that's pretty common for, you know, families.
Oh yeah.
And because my dad, he turned 62. So he's not quite at the age where he can get Medicare, but Medicare came up as a topic because it was his birthday and he's getting older. And, and so his older sister was talking about her Medicare and started to complain rather loudly. And she's like a, you know, like a liberal, you know, kind of Biden supporter. And my grandparents are like, they watch Fox News. They love Trump, da, 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 very different. And they started to talk about,
why I just don't want to be in families. Like, oh my God, these polarizations.
And
go ahead.
Yeah. As soon as the healthcare conversation started to develop and my aunt was kind of, you know, saying a few things and we were talking and I was just keeping my mouth shut, to be honest. And my grandma said she was like, oh, we never had healthcare and you just need to think positively, which is some Fox News brainwashing. Yeah. Anyway. But pretty soon, shortly after this conversation started, they just got up and left. They didn't even say goodbye. They just left and went home.
Wait, right. Your aunt did.
My grandparents.
Your grandparents. Okay. Yeah. Well, you know what? That's old people too. Like, sorry. Like, I feel like I'm going to
do
that.
How do we do this? Like, what are...
You were talking to somebody with one child and like, we barely have any friends that we really, really keep up with. That's on, you know, we keep whatever, wanting to, it's a lot of work. But the effort is worth it. It truly, truly is. This is one thing we had gone traveling. We met a couple that we really adore. They live in Ridgeway near Telluride. Mm-hmm. So after all these bizarre meetings, you know, I don't believe in coincidence. I don't know. You just put things together as a human. It's not, I don't think it's magic, but we met each other way too many times and we're like, okay, universe, we're going to be friends.
Yeah.
We made the effort to go.
Tickets.
We went to see my brother. We went down to Telluride. We had a phenomenal time. And it's just, it is worth the effort. And that is one thing I think, at least in the neglect type of environment that I grew up in, with parents that grew up in also a sort of a neglected rural Alabama, this whole thing of like, oh, getting all your shit together to go to the beach. You know, I always hated the fucking beach because we'd go to the beach as kids and take one shitty ass towel, no drinks, no umbrella, no food, no nothing. And so it's like,
that sounds terrible.
It was awful, you know? I mean, boring. And so I sort of carried that into carried it on in to like, I really did some work in therapy about what that is to actually make the fucking effort, you know, and it not be this like, oh, this is so terrible, you know, because that's sort of what it felt like, that whole piece of families are a burden. Without a farm, without a rural community to kind of like, we weren't growing food. We weren't laying hogs and dealing with chickens. And there was no, so they got pulled out of that. And then they're in this modern world and they don't know how to do, I think, just joy and pleasure. Just, this is fun. Like, I grew up an hour from where I live now. There are so many trails. Like, we try to hike as much as we can. It's like really, really worth the effort. So I don't know. That took a long time to do. So you got to make efforts in your relationships too. And I didn't for a long time. I thought you just married somebody and then you lived in the same house. You didn't have to do anything. You didn't have to show love or.
I just want to share reflections from our last episode. I just want to say thank you to
I had poop hangover, by the way, from our last episode.
Poop, a little bit of
poop hangover. Like
vulnerability hangover.
Vulnerability. Would that be shared too much?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Totally. So absolutely. Yeah. But just how many people shared the This American Life podcast. It's funny, I guess the world was ready to share their embarrassing bathroom stories because This American Life, which you all, if you haven't listened to that episode, it's the embarrassing stories. I felt so cringy listening to those stories, but then like also like so good after, like, oh, embarrassing things happen to everyone, you know? So yes, so cathartic.
That's how we connect.
But then My Favorite Murder also, she had an embarrassing pee story where she was like,
really?
In the middle of a pee and someone was like, you can't pee there. And she had to like quickly, you know, I was like, this is the week. The world was ready.
At my age, there is no cutting off that stream. I mean, streams are coming out with like just at any point, you know? So yeah, it just gets, it gets more and more embarrassing as you get older. So we might as well start talking about it now.
I know. So anyway, thanks to everyone who sent that our way, because that was great. The other feedback I've been getting about our podcast is that my friends are like, I never realized that I was a latchkey kid until your podcast, but I was.
Really? Yes.
Yeah. People don't.
They just didn't have a key. Maybe they left their door open.
Exactly. That's actually exactly right. They're like, well, we never locked our door, but my parents were not around.
Yeah.
You know, and they weren't making us food and they weren't, you know, like some of them are like, I didn't have a set bedtime. I didn't, you know. Wild.
Yeah.
Just wild. Yeah. Wild childhoods. The alternate name for our podcast.
Yeah. Totally.
I wanted to let all our listeners know that I have set up this really cool tool on our website so that you can leave us a message, an audio message that we could play. And so I still think I really like the current prompt that we put out there in episode one, which is, do you have emotionally healthy grandparents? And it ties into what I was saying today as well. Do you have emotionally healthy grandparents? And if you do, please go to our website, latchkeyurchins.com/tell us. And then you could also just go to our homepage and click tell us. And so that's where you would tell us our story. And if you just go to that page, then you can record and we get an email that you have sent us your little story. And so, it has all the instructions right on there. And so then, we'll play some of them. We want to hear about, I'm dying to hear about people's emotionally healthy grandparents, actually. So,
All right.
So now, here's the interview with Anne and Tom. It's kind of like, am I interviewing the two of you? I think a little bit.
Am I part of the interview too?
I think you were. Yeah. I think I interviewed the two of you. I don't know. Okay.
All right.
Here it is.
All right.
But I just can't keep telling you what to think now.
It's great to see you again and talk with you. I've always enjoyed our conversations. I think, you know, we first met 2014. I came down to Asheville for a little visit. And so I think, you know, one of the things we're trying to start asking our guests now is to talk about, you know, latchkey childhood. How do you relate to that? What was the emotional environment of your childhood?
I wasn't technically latchkey.
I want to know why or why not, you know.
My mother was home when I got home from school.
Mm-hmm.
So in that technicality, you know, but that's very different than the concept of neglect that we've been talking, that you guys are working through.
Yep.
And one of the things that Anne and I have been toying with through the course of our marriage is like the different kinds of neglect we experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time, I thought that I had it worse than Anne, because I had neglect interlaced with judgment.
Mm-hmm.
So you weren't being paid attention to, but you were always being criticized for whatever you do. right? So you never knew what you were doing right or wrong, or like you could never win, you could never do anything right. Mm-hmm. So you're getting paid attention to, but it was all just judgment. Like you never looked right, you never acted right, you're blah, 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 blah.
Totally.
And like, man, that was really hard. You know, I had neglect and judgment. And then as we've worked with Anne, as Anne's been working through her stuff, is like, that's really different than indifferent neglect.
Yep.
Like where there's true indifference.
Yep.
And watching her go through the challenges of that kind of neglect has been really, you know, you know, it's not like it's a competition.
But
that's really, really there's some benefits to my side. Like, at least I was being paid attention to be criticized.
Right. My therapist said the same thing to me. She actually said in a lot of cases, neglect can be worse than abuse, because abuse, at least you know you exist. Someone is affirming your existence. But neglect, it's like there's no grounding. It's just like, do I exist? Do I matter? That's a really deep wound. The kind of, does anyone even care that I exist? That's deep.
Well,
yeah, and I think the kids that, sorry, Tom, that often you be, if you're, especially if you're the hero in the family of that family system, usually you're going to find kids taking on different roles. And so I became the hero. I'll get my sense of self met in the external world. So it's all about kind of this hypervigilance to like, well, how do you do this? Well, I'll just be really good at this. And so you literally have no needs, you know, and you get a lot of accolades. So you're athletic, or you try to be good in school, but you don't have really good study habits often, or there's just no staying power. It's like a very two-dimensional experience. It's not, it just isn't that deep, and it, you'll crumble at some point. So I see that's a type of person I love to see in therapy, because they've been looking good. This whole entire society says you're good, you're good, you're good. You do stuff, you achieve. And it's this two-dimensional achieve. I mean, if you look around the side of them, it's like literally there often is not much depth. So
whereas for me, it was like my job, because of the judgment part, was to disappear. Like I became the nicest human on the planet, because I just didn't want to get criticized. So I just learned how to be just super nice.
Ugh.
And I was always known for being like the nicest kid in the world, you know? And it was not until my early 40s where I realized that that was a protector and a part and a manager. And like, I had to like learn how to be an asshole, and like, oh, there's some advantages to being an asshole sometimes. Like I can, like being able to advocate for myself and express my needs and my wants and desires, instead of always subjugating myself to the other, because that was the safer route, was a long-term process. It's like, no, I'm important. My needs are valuable. But you don't learn that when you're just trying to be quiet and safe and not be criticized.
Yeah.
And but so you were also drawn to parenting. I mean, like working with adolescents, you knew what you wanted to do, right? Like this, I'm going to be a therapist. You knew like somewhere in your 20s or even earlier than that, and got interested in
parenting. No, I'm one of those weird people that I knew. I didn't choose this profession. Like I knew I was going to kayak. I knew I was going to farm. I knew I was going to be a therapist by the time I was 15 years old. Like I was monomaniacal towards those goals from a very young age. Like I didn't choose this job. It's just, this is what I do.
And why do you think that is? Why were you drawn to it?
I'm still working on that. I have a lot of work to do on that, because there's a part of me that really believes, I'm like you, I'm a devout rationalist, like to an extreme degree, but there's a part of me that feels it feels sometimes like I have knowledge that I didn't learn. Like I was like born with some of these understandings that they somehow came to me. It's kind of sometimes a weird thing. It's just like, I was always a very observant, quiet, kind. I always was confused by like, why are people arguing?
So there was something of the peacemaker in you.
Yeah, just had a big heart. I had a big heart.
Okay. Oh, I see. I see. I see. And so why teens? Why are you drawn to working with teens?
I don't know if I think I sort of fell into teens a little bit, but I grew to really like them. I liked the complexity of the family system. And I sort of liked the sort of orchestration aspect, but there's a plasticity to teens that's really mm-hmm. lovely to work mm-hmm. with. Mm-hmm. There's this emergence and there's this sense of self. And I do a lot of stuff on like role definition, like this emergence from being the son or daughter of your parents or sibling of your siblings into being the person you're going to be. Mm-hmm. And in the teen years, that's where that transition happens. You know, I'd run thought experiments. Like if I were to make your family drop off the face of the earth tomorrow, then who are you? And for a really young kid, that's an impossible question to answer because totally. they can't see their lives outside of the context of that ecosystem. But as they get, you know, 14, 15, then that starts to really happen. And, you know, and you're sort of guiding that process.
And it makes me think of all the most compelling movies are like that those teen development, like Ferris Bueller's Day Off or The Breakfast mm-hmm. Club or mm-hmm. Dead Poets Society. You know, right. they're just like heart-wrenching in some ways where you're just, you're sucked into the whole feeling. That's like such a uniquely teenager feeling. Like everything matters so much.
Right.
Developmentally, that is exactly how it feels. You know I work with teens and it is, it's like 50 billion times feeling more at that time. And it lasts a long time. Like we're on a speeded up schedule as our lives are flashing by, but teens, yeah. it lasts a long time in their world. So
do you two have a favorite teen angst movie?
Oh, Breakfast Club. that damn song comes on that at the end, it do me every single time. I'm like, yes, yes. I wanted to be the rebel so bad that I was like, I wasn't Molly Ringwald, but I was maybe Anthony Michael Hall or something. Just the good kid. I was just good, you know, but secretly like had this shadow side that was, but I couldn't go too far because my older brother was off the charts, cops, everything, you know, he got to play that role. So anyways, yeah.
Well, I mean, speaking of the my work is adolescent. I mean, you can't work with adolescents. You're working within a system. And what I grew to really appreciate was sort of navigating the family system, you know, and really what I've grown, the job was a lot of like trying to help the parents get out of the kid's way, you know, and helping the kid like not let, you know, finding their own way. And that whole stuff about how much does a parent let go, how much does a parent hold on, how much does the kid let go, how much does the kid hold on, and all those complications that happen, you know, it's a really dicey, very, very volatile, and it's a moving target. And that dealing with the parents became really what I liked doing the most. Mm-hmm.
Dealing with the parents. What do you mean by that?
Teaching, like parents come to parenting with a tremendous amount of fear and anxiety and a tremendous amount of like responsibility, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you know, and they want to do it right. And they want to do it, all this sort of stuff. And there's this, all this angst and energy and focus these days on the kid. And I'm like, just shut up, you know, just back off. Like, you know, this isn't about you, you know, you are not the maker or breaker of your child's future, you know.
But that's their own trauma coming up, right?
Yeah, it's their own trauma and this whole idea, this whole trauma. And I think there's some stuff about, I don't want to get too philosophical, there's some about sort of industrial revolution stuff. It's like, you know, we can control this. We can make this happen. I can create this person. you know, the 1950s sort of tabula rasa. You could like make your kid, you know, behaviorism, like you can create this thing. Like you have all of this power to mold this creature into something.
Yeah.
And it's like you're imposing on them.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, back away. They have a life and an energy and a beauty of their own. If you just get out of the way.
Yeah.
And all you're there to shepherd that, not to mold it.
Yeah.
That is very different than like the neglect we talk about, right? The neglect. Like,
but it's still
no concept of family, or it's free range.
It's sort of still neglect though, isn't it, Anne? You know, this like the child is
definitely
extension of myself.
Yeah.
It's like,
no, but when Tom's saying get out of the way, just let your kid, but that is a different get out of the way than don't even pretend you have children.
Right. Yeah. That's completely different.
Yeah. Can you talk with that? It sounds like
the subtleties of getting out of the way.
The subtleties of getting out of the way and then pretending as if, you know, these leeches in your household, if they would just leave, then we could get back to our life is sort of.
Oddly enough, I had a dream about this last night. Whereas like, I was in a conversation, maybe because I knew I was be talking to you guys today, but like, what is the basic foundation of my sort of philosophy of parenting? Right.
Yeah.
What, you know, what is the core of it? And in the dream, the core was trust. It's like, I trust that my kid's going to be okay. Like, mm-hmm. I have a deep abiding faith that they're going to be okay. And my only job as a parent is to get them into an independent adulthood. That's a gold medal. Whether they're happy or whatever, satisfied, whatever, that's all gravy. That's kind of on that.
Yeah.
You know, but my job is just to get them so I am here for you is sort of like getting out of their way is you're available and present and supportive, but you're not imposing. You know, it's more of an act of listening than it is preaching. It's more of a dialogue than like, what is the kind of teaching word? It's didactic, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, here are the mm-hmm. steps.
I really truly believe that children know how to become adults more than we do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that all we have to do is just listen and pay attention to them and they will tell us what they need. And it's love is just the act of like being there and listening and being available for them,
yeah.
Holding space for them to teach me
who they are,
what they need, as opposed to me getting up in their grill and trying to like do, you know, they're more invested in becoming an adult than I am. They want to get their genes in the next generation. I already did that. You know?
But why is this so hard? I mean, to me, as you're speaking and I'm like, you're saying some very simple concepts that are very profound. Like I'm like absorbing them and I'm like, this is truth. I'm hearing truth. Why is this so hard for parents? Why? Maybe you don't have an answer, but and I'll be here, both of you.
I did a paper on midwifery. And mm-hmm. we have a lot of C-sections we have in this country. And part of it is because doctors are not used to not doing anything. they're not used to like just letting the natural process take place. It's like, it feels really weird to not be in control. You know, we build dams, we build buildings. We're like this idea that we're like in control of nature. And like, we want to impose our this intellect on the world and create something. Mm-hmm. And really the world is much more magical and amazing than you'll ever be able to make it. So just back off and let it do its job.
But that doesn't fly when you're at your like cocktail parties and stuff and all the comparing is going on and where's your kid going to school and how many accolades does your kid have? If you just show up and you're like, I don't know, they're just kind of unfolding, you know, we just kind of, they're letting me know. It just doesn't, I think that's some of it too. There's a lot of this, like that, again, white supremacist culture pieces that we bring into this, just Tim O'Kuhn stuff. It's just, all that ascension, you know, like they must be the best and we're comparing. So, and I, somehow the kids that have been, I mean, I think the pandemic has been really helpful that parents felt, a lot of parents talked about getting a sigh of relief. I don't have to have my kid at every freaking practice. You know, the family got to kind of connect again. So I'm really interested at how, what this year or 18 months is going to have the wisdom, the innate wisdom that it might've released a little bit. So.
And would you agree with that sort of how we play the game with him? We just like, we just.
Yeah. But I can also, I will say I could feel once he got to school, we had him in sort of a Waldorf inspired preschool.
You're how old is he? Just for our listeners.
Almost nine.
Okay.
And he, you know, we're like, yeah, nature, cool, awesome, excellent. And he loved it. But he did have to go to a school in kindergarten, and kindergarten's more playful. But that first grade year was rough, where you are sitting in a chair. It's still a pretty, expressive, you know, nature-based school-ish. But it is, you know, it's a charter school, but it's in line with, like, you've got to meet these goals, these achievements. He really struggled. And I was like, oh, we should have been, he didn't have a pen in his hand or pencil. We didn't do his fine motor skills. Like, I really had to sit with a lot of like, we fucked up. I fucked up. I was just like, you know, and I was like, oh, and then sort, so how the process for me, I was able to see those as parts, but he's behind, we need to hold him back. We've messed up. I started questioning these natural inclinations I had. He's a very physical kid. Mm-hmm. He never really did like having a pen in his hand or pencil or book. And I was like, oh, that stupid ass Waldorf. We took it too far. You know, they're not supposed to read until they get their teeth in. And he still got baby teeth. But it was this internal, and I can imagine without the internal family systems knowledge, without like being an older parent that's like, yeah. So there was enough of that, but I could feel how something happening that I had messed up. I could just feel that thread coming.
And then what would that mean? Like, what would that mean? You know, if you had messed up.
Well, growing up the hero in my childhood, it was like, it felt like death
or something. Yeah. Like, yep. I can't, if I messed up in any way.
Tom rolled with that a whole lot better. I think, right?
I have a real different take on that.
Yeah, Tom's, okay, Tom's please. A calmer parent in a lot of ways. So,
yeah, I mean, everything Anne's saying is true, but I mean, I have a phrase that a couple phrases that I try to live with when it comes to parenting. You know, well, I've got three phrases. One is there's no way to do it right, and there's only a few ways to do it wrong. So chill the fuck out, right? I do believe that in my core, right? I also believe this, you know, the phrase, like, it all comes out in the wash.
Yeah.
You know, like, and with him, in terms of talking to him, the phraseology in my own head is, you'll figure it out. You know, these are sort of mantras I keep going back to, like, you'll figure it out.
Yeah.
Now, when it comes to like the school stuff, like the times when that broke down for me, right, where he was really struggling with school and throwing temper tantrums and like couldn't put a pen, like, it really, from my experience, my freakouts were not about him. My freakouts were about me. Like, I don't want to live in a household for the next 10 years where I'm forcing my kid to do his homework, like having to fight with my kid all the time to do schoolwork. I still believe it was going to come out in the wash, like it was going to be fine. It's just that was a world I didn't want to live in. Like, I didn't want to live in a world where I'm fighting with my kid about school all the time.
Yeah.
Right. And so that was a matter of this dial, like, list, like, what does this kid need? And how do I just sort of, you know, sit with it and like hold that belief that it all comes out in the wash and just sort of like not stress out. Mm-hmm. And just sort of sit with that and just sort of like, well, if there's special needs that come up, then we'll deal with them. And, you know, his teeth come in and he figures it out. And, you know, it wasn't worth stressing about. It's like, you know, just sort of like, none of it's really worth stressing about.
I've talked about this book too before. The Parenting from the Inside Out. I think, Tom, you're naturally referring to a lot of that. It is about paying attention to how did you grow up? What traumas, what are you putting on? Where are you parenting from fear, by Daniel Siegel. And I do also want to say, you know, we don't have a lot of other external stressors. You know, we're pretty financed.
Especially being older parents. I mean, that was a lot of the stress in my household growing up was financial because they're so young.
Yeah. The other piece, so we did bring in community around when he was maybe three-ish or something. Being older parents, this was another thing that led me to this, like, oh God, we're supposed to be in community. And that's such a weird concept. Like, he has no siblings. He has cousins that are all much older. I was like, we're going to die. And this kid's still going to be relatively, I don't know, who knows, but like, we're older parents and he needs to know this concept of community. So that was another reason for joining our church. And we have been struggling and we're getting better and better at it. But that has been important for us, I think, growing up the way we did, me pretty individualistically, you too, Tom. But he needs a solid community. And that actually brought us to maybe him being able to learn things we didn't learn about racial justice, about inequity. Like, that is just freely talked about in our communities. And we don't hold a lot back. He's pretty familiar about what's going on in this world, because I do think that's a piece of you're trying to parent, but you can't control these external forces in American society, right? And I really see these kids are dealing with climate change. They're dealing with inequities, polarization, the Trump era. Like, that is impacting his early life. That if you pretend those things aren't existing, it's really rough on kids, I think.
Yeah, I'm having, Anne's talking about community. I find community very hard.
Yeah.
I find being, and I'm sitting here listening to Anne and the thought that I'm having is that I didn't grow up in a family. Right. I had a mother and a father. I had an older brother and two older sisters. We all lived in the same house, but there was no family. I describe it as a house of pandas, pandas live individual solitary lives. We had like six solitary people trapped under the same house. There was no this third entity, you know, like in a couple, there's me, you, and there's this us. There's this amorphous third thing, this us.
Yeah.
And family is this amorphous third thing that you kind of are comforted by, and you can't touch it, but you can feel its presence. And I think if you grow up inside a family, you're like, oh, I know this thing, this outside thing that can comfort me and hold me. And that emerges into a community.
Mm-hmm.
Like that becomes community. But if you didn't grow up with that comfort or that entity, or even having any understanding of what that envelope is feeling, then there's no drive to have community because you don't know what that feels like to begin with.
Yeah.
Like I don't know what I don't have any physical experience of feeling like I'm part of a family. I don't have none of us can. Yeah,
So like, what are the micro behaviors of a family that has a third entity or, you know, a community feeling to it? What didn't happen in your childhood or probably mine or Anne's? What are the tangible things that didn't happen?
People giving a shit about anything.
I mean, like experiences, really. I mean, we like today, you know, I've been busy this morning. And I mean, so there is it's not like we know later today, let us really put some effort into what can the three of us do together? That is a together thing, not just like, okay, I'm tired, I'm just going to check out. You know, it doesn't.
Being
present and saying, here's the range of options. Let's go spend some time together. Let's spend some time together is like a weird concept.
You enjoy being around each other.
Yeah.
Like a house of, we're all individuals. There was no there's no cross-pollination of interests or behaviors or humor or anything. It was just, it's just like having communal experience where you're all experiencing the same thing together. And it sort of creates this sort of yeasty environment that feels good.
Yeah.
There's Gabor Mate has a book, I think, called Hold Your Kids Close or Hold Your Kids Tight or something. And he does talk about, like, you need to hold your, otherwise they're going to, blow out of it. And they're the experts in their world are their peers who are not experts. So this whole thing of, like, I think he would posit that this thing of, like, oh, teens just disappear for a while. That's not actually natural. They will differentiate, but a pattern of neglect blows your kids away from you. They're not going to share anything. And we see that as normal. Like, yeah, my teen just disappeared. Would you say, Tom, that there are families where teens do like to check in with their parents, or, you know, probably because they
freak out on shit. There's all sorts of stuff about parents who don't individuate. I mean, there's a whole developmental process for parents too, which we haven't talked about, is like this identity of being parenting. You have to go through that life stage too, where you let go of that role and identity too. And some parents have a really hard time letting go of that identity. Mm-hmm. And so they hold on to their children when their children are trying to get away. And in some, you know, like there's a lot of people, parents don't understand that they're going through developmental life stages too.
Mm.
We all focus on our child's growing up, but you're growing up too.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
You're going through a very similar differentiation that your child is. You're sloughing off this role of parent. And if you really love being a parent, there's a lot of grief associated with that.
Yeah.
You know? And some parents have a real hard time doing that. I mean, that wasn't hard. That wasn't true in my family, because there was, you know, it was not, that wasn't kind of the deal.
Right.
What do you think were the, maybe some of the factors at play? Maybe like, I like the philosophical stuff that you bring in, the historical stuff. In your family of origin, Tom, and also you, Anne, like what created, you know, because these parenting styles are pretty typical. What created that?
Like,
the House of Pandas? What created my House of Pandas?
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, I'm not. That's a great question, Allison.
That's a great question. I think there's also, this is a whole other thing, but I think there's a depression era psychology where, you know, financial and like making sure everything was happening, like all of that stuff, the stress of just managing a family's financial unit was really stressful during that period of time. Like that was the priority, because those people lived through the collapse of that, you know, there. And so parenting really wasn't the dominant concern for them. It was making sure that there was still food on the table and shelter. Sense. It's like the primary thing is, my job is not to be a good parent. My job is to make sure you're fed and you go to school. And, you know, that's, the rest is gravy for them.
Yeah.
And I get that.
Yeah.
You know, there's also in my family system, there's narcissism, and there's, you know, there's some other where, you know, the needs of one particular, or, you know, the, your needs are not important. The needs of that person are important.
Yeah. And I know I'm anecdotal. I'm not speaking for every 70s childhood of the entire experience. There are some threads that are just how it was structurally. But my parents grew up in, they were born in 38 in rural Alabama. So I keep reminding myself, I had the experiences of I don't know if it's a generation, but I'm removed. Like I thought the world was black and white, you know, mm-hmm. it was like, and there was no, they didn't do money. I mean, it was like subsistence farming. You had 10 and 7 children because you needed workers. And, but that was not, I was off time with a lot of my peers whose parents did, grow up with electricity and cars. And that was mind blowing to me. So certainly from my experience and, you know, lots and lots of work that I've done, there's a lot of, really understanding like, holy hell, they had no skills. And then they were the 70s. I don't know. It was their money was tight. And it must have been an insanely stressful experience all the time. I'd want, if it were that stressful, you want kids out of the house. It was probably like, yeah, go sell mm-hmm. some Girl Scout cookies, get out of here. Or whatever. Like, the more time the kids are out of the house, the more you can like breathe or something. But it was also sanctioned a bit, you know, like.
Oh, God.
And I think about like the piece that you both bring up around how hard it is to be in community. And I also think about like the history of America basically being a country of immigrants, of a lot of European immigrants, and mm-hmm. that movement away from your home community, leaving mm-hmm. your home community, yeah. coming to a new place, how isolating and traumatizing that whole energy is. That's like the story. I mean, and you know, as well as the energy of all the indigenous people here who died as a result of that. Yeah. Yeah. But that's some dark energy to start a country off with.
Right. And it's really recent. I mean, I'm like third generation Irish, you know, it's like, that's yeah. not far. And the potato famine. And I mean, it is imbued into, you know, we're sloughing off of a lot of that stuff. And
yeah.
And going back sort of this, the whole concept of neglect. I mean, my mantra is my job is to get my kid into an independent adulthood. And yeah. on that metric, my parents deserve a gold medal. I, you know, my traumas and my sufferings and my stuff, that's on me to figure out. That's right. me. That's my life. But on balance, they succeeded in that goal. Hmm. Like, mm-hmm. So I don't fault that. I do a lot of work on myself, but that's work for me to do. That's just my stuff. I can't blame them for it.
We have talked about, Allison and I have throughout this, you know, talked about that having enough, it's a little bit like a recipe. And I think what we're trying to do here when you do work is if there's too much or the system of the child can get, you know, that can be so overwhelming that it's almost like they don't have enough, I guess, access to their self or to be able to do the work on some level, you know, so it's there's so, something. Yeah, go ahead.
I want to interject just because in my own life, there were times when I thought my trauma felt so heavy, I wasn't yeah. sure I was going to make it out alive. Yeah. And I lost right. two cousins my age, to suicide. Two yep. of them yep. were the same age. And so for those of us who grew up in the 80s, we're seeing deaths of despair on the rise. We're seeing drug use on the rise. I'm seeing among my peers, I don't feel this way anymore. And of course I got a diagnosis. Those feelings that I was feeling are called major depressive disorder. I don't want to be here. Right. But that's not, that's not just me and my family. That's like my yeah, generation is, this yeah. is dark. This is dark. Yeah.
Well, the way yeah. that I talk about this, yeah. I've been talking about this with parents, like parents try to protect their children from suffering. And I'm like, no, you know, you don't want to protect your children. There's a balance. You want enough suffering. Like suffering is the engine of development is what I tell my parents. So like you want enough suffering that it drives growth, but too much suffering inhibits growth.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where support and community and all those other things we're talking about and family balances that out. Like you can actually handle more suffering when you have community. You can grow yeah. more and you can become more. That's why it's so valuable when you don't have that support, you can't handle as much and you can collapse. God knows how many times I've been suicidal in my life, you know? It's trying to balance that edge.
Yeah. But that road to community, and I don't know, maybe part of me is like, do you hear me? Like, it's really hard because for me, it looks good on the surface. It's two-dimensional. And Tom and I have talked about this, both of us for different reasons. You think you're in our house, but we'll invite you into the vestibule, and it's very pretty, you know, but it is a small room. Nobody's getting in the big house, you know.
People think they're in my house.
And it's like, oh gosh. And so you try to, I could find myself, like, as I was really trying to work on this, expressing like, oh, it's really hard to be here. I don't want to do this. And people are like, but you're so friendly and you belong so much. I'm like, it's all an act, you know? So the actual belonging piece, I guess if any listeners are out there that just take your time, keep showing up.
What you're talking about is vulnerability.
Vulnerability.
You know, what you're talking about is like I've been saying that, like, I have a tremendous, like, people think they're in my house. And after they get to know me for a couple of years, they realize that, oh my God, I don't know who this person, like, I'm safe as can be in my little house, in my house. You think you're in my house because I'm the friendliest guy you ever met, but you're not in my house. And because it's just not safe. And I think that's where really this is an interesting conversation, because what I didn't anticipate in this conversation is the role of the understanding of family and how that morphs into community and how important community is, and how much I am. I'm tearful here. Like, how much there's, like, I'm terrified. I'm literally almost terrified of the idea of community, you know? It's just like, I love my wife and my kid. I could just live in my own little bubble with the two of them. And then, like, that's good for me.
That's the me and mine paradox. I call them, you know, the me and miners. Go ahead.
Well, right before we started recording, you saw some community members trying to cross the street.
Oh, right.
Having a really hard time. And some part of your subconscious was like, I got to intervene.
I got
to
go get.
That's community to me.
I'm telling you, that wouldn't have happened like 3 or 4 years ago. I'm like, no, I can't get in the left lane and do a wacky U-turn to go get this woman and her elderly father who's about to collapse in the street. And there is sort of more of a, one, I watched my mother do that, but I was like, they need help. Like, so there wasn't so much in the way of, what does this look like? Is it okay? Are they crazy? Are they going to do something? I was like, those people need help. I got to go do it.
But there's something in you too. It's like, I'm hearing you say that community's hard. And I guess I'm also saying, like, well, I guess you really are doing a great job of pretending, because in 2014, when I texted you and was like, hey, surprise, I'm in Asheville. I mean, your immediate response is that you were just like, we're hosting you, come on over. You know,
well, you're me and mine, though. You're me and mine. Allison, you're a mine, you know. I'll take care of me and mine. I mean, it has been, I guess I want to clarify. I think sometimes I speak in terms of where I've been to be illustrative, but I love what you said, Tom, that I didn't really realize this, that this us having a connected family, you just evolve. Then you're like, oh, the family's safe. So that we probably could evolve into a community, and we really need a community to just stay at that piece. And the racial justice work that I engaged in, I was like, no freaking way can I be with all of, trying to be effective at all unless I am in a community that can help bear the horror of that, so that you stay in it. You know, I think a lot of times we get in that work and we don't have this sense of a safe community to work through, and the length of time it takes to work in that and do your own evolution. But it just takes time. And I think we, you know, we're just sort of trusting, right, Tom?
I mean, I've been working through this idea, this idea of community, we probably, there's a whole nother topic, but like what enables a person, and maybe it is the neglect, like what enables a person to feel part of a community? Like what are the foundations that are built into a child that where community is available to them? They get nourished by it. They seek it, blah, 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 blah. And the way that I've been working through this idea of wholesale versus retail love, like I am really good at wholesale. Like the checkout person, the checkout line, a person on the street, like I can love like the best of them wholesale, but but retail where I have to like, they have to get to know me a little bit. Like I'm not good at retail. Like that's community to me. It's like, they're actually going to get to know me. I actually have to show up. I can give as much as I, but receiving yeah. or being
yeah.
seen.
Yeah. That's being relatable. Seen,
yeah.
Is, you know, like we've talked about earlier, like being seen is how you become in a good family. Being seen is what makes you exist. And, you know, like being paid attention to is how you know you exist in the world. And if you're right. not being paid attention to, you have to develop that on your own. Like it's in your own head. It's like, I exist. I think, therefore I am. Like I don't need another person out there to show me that I exist, because I've sort of developed it on my own because I grew up in this kind of neglectful environment. So I don't have to go out in the world and I don't need people to like show me I exist, because I had to learn how to become a person by myself. So
but you're working, that's an evolutionary stage, because like it's right. I mean, I know you love living there. And we're not going to make it in this world if, you know, environmentally, with activism, with evaluating these structures that are just awful to people, like that damn Biltmore bus that dropped that elderly man and his daughter off to walk down a huge busy street. Anyways, that happened. Like that, it was against the rules, I think, for the bus to move forward. You know, I can't leave the grounds or something. It was like, just take him to the... somebody help them get to lunch, you know, but the bus driver's fine. You made your choice. So get off the bus. And he nearly collapsed in the street. So it's just a weird, like, why is this happening? Why would anybody allow this to happen? Including her on some level, like ask for help, you know? So it's wacky. Mm. Yeah. I don't, as an avowed not ask for helper. I know it.
People grew up in our environment that we're talking about. That's one of our major, like asking for help. Oh God, hell, that ain't happening.
Tom and I coined the term independent personality disorder, which Alice, I've mentioned on this.
I love that so much.
It comes up in my therapy. Like it really should be a diagnosis. It is the right diagnosis to describe.
Every American is suffering from it.
We have independent personality disorder.
As a nation.
Yeah.
Yeah. We've been brainwashed to think that we can pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. It's literally not possible. I mean,
nor do you want to. I have to say, as I evolve into this, I'm like, holy shit, this feels better. Like to actually be glad to see somebody, for somebody just to reflexively say, hey, can I help you? Or, hey, you look a little sad. Could I give you a hug? Which I'm like, oh, stiff as a board, but probably need that, you know, like, how did you see that? How embarrassing. But like that people, there is, it feels better. It just feels better.
I'm remembering now, this memory came into my head that and when I think when I came to visit, I think in 2014, because I came again in 2018, that mm-hmm. I maybe said something to you that was in gratitude to your hosting me and to all of our good conversations and maybe some compliments. And you, I can't remember if there was more, if it was like compliments or whatever. And you were like, I'm going to practice receiving this. You
know? Oh, yeah. That was in my like, and that receiving nourishment, like,
but that just left an impression on me, because it was like, oh, I'm seeing someone practice this receiving, which mm-hmm. I hadn't done that yet for myself, that work.
Yeah,
you know, hearing you say that, I am gonna
and 7 years ago,
especially for you to not just immediately deflect and then let me now like reflexively give it back. That also left a huge positive impression on me of you were just like, cool, I'm just going to receive it. I'm just going to leave it there. Like, so good.
Just leave it there.
I have these moments of expansion and then severe contraction. We're going to do this. I have an idea for a podcast episode. Tom, you know all about this, like visiting Love Town, you know, where you go on there for vacation and it feels good, but you've got to save the money up. Like that's like thousands of dollars of therapy to maybe timeshare in Love Town, you know?
I don't know if I want to stay there.
Everybody's so happy and loving each other.
Because feeling loved is going back to neglect, feeling loved is uncomfortable for us. We're not used to it. It's like we're being appreciated or being complimented. Like I remember what you're talking about with Anne. I remember we used to have dinner. I used to cook a lot and have dinner parties. And one night Anne says, "Your meal was really good tonight." And I said, "Yeah, thanks a lot." And she almost fell out of the bed. And because normally I would have said, "Well, I should have done this, or that was okay, or this could have been
that
better."
Was huge.
And she's like, "Wait a minute, just stop and just hear what you just said." That I was able to.
That's
just
probably around the time with you, Allison.
Yeah.
It was I just was able to feel that. And I mean, it's a challenge. It's a real learning thing. It takes effort. Yeah. It doesn't take effort for me to love, but it takes a lot of effort for me to be loved.
Yes, that's good. Yeah.
We do
this with August. I think we drive him a little. I don't know. We'll have August once we're dead and gone. Allison, you're 16 years younger. Have August on.
Yeah.
Like if it keeps going and we'll see how he turns out.
You two are both
going
to live very long.
Dead and gone. Yeah, because he's like, "Oh my God, my parents, Jesus, the shit they handed me." Anyways, but we will say, "Hey, August, what's it feel like to be loved? Like, what's that feel like?" He's like, "Shut up. You know, what's it like?" And we even did an experiment with him parenting wise. Basically he said it felt like candy or warm or something like that.
Said it felt warm. Yeah.
It felt warm. And then I said, "Hey, let's do a little bit of, let me give you some of my childhood." And we had him, he was like, "Yeah, he loves my stories of growing up in the 70s and how wild and urchiny it was."
Urchiny.
It's like hearing tales of a pirate or something. I mean, he laughs. So I think that's part of like, just share. I don't know what my parents' upbringing was like, but it is fun to share how it was, how we're different. But I was just like reading a paper or something and completely ignoring him. And he could tolerate it for about 3 seconds, and he was "Stop it! I don't like it." You know, so I was like, "Okay, I think we're doing all right." You know,
that's hilarious.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, advocating for yourself is the other piece. It's like I'm valuable enough to advocate for myself.
Yeah. Mm.
Whereas, when you grow up in our environment, it's like you don't ask for anything.
Mm-mm.
You just learned from a very young age, I could ask. I'm not going to get anything in return. So yeah, like, I stop asking.
Why asking?
Yeah.
I'm going to get criticized for asking.
Yes.
I'm going to get attention, but I'm going to get attention that doesn't feel good.
Right.
So you know, you just sort of like figure out how to live on your own.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're just gonna wrap up, but Tom, we'll have you back again. And I love talking about the historical and philosophical context of all of these like interpersonal and personal ideas. So I you know, can't wait to see you again in person so we can nerd out on all these, you know, and then we'll have you back.
I'll send you the chapters of the book I'm working on, and then
we can really
nerd out.
You don't have the title, but the subtitle is "Chill the Fuck Out."
No, I think the title is "Chill the Fuck Out." Parenting and Confident Kids.
The word "fuck" is having a renaissance in book titles right now. So I think you're like, what was? Isn't there a Mark Manson one? What's his?
Oh, yeah.
The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. And there's been some other ones. Yeah, there's a whole, it's a movement. So
I am doing my best to take the power out of that word. Just ask August. Yeah.
It's a weird line between paying attention and neglect is really what this edge is. It's like you pay attention, but you're not paying, but it's that sense
of you having your own self, and your child has a different self. I think that you're really, that is your, that what I'm getting is like your main point. That's is right. Like there's,
yeah,
And so almost like if a parent is arriving at parenting and they don't know who their capital S self is, they've never asked, they've never seen it, they weren't raised to have their self acknowledged, they're going to start, you know, having this enmeshment with their kid where the boundaries are confused and they don't understand where they end and where their kid starts, right?
Or I think you also don't accurately perceive their motivations or, you know, like your story of the spilt milk too. Like, it's like, my kid didn't spill that on purpose. You know, you just get, you reflexively are engaging in these activities.
Or that enmeshment where your child's suffering is not your suffering. It's their suffering. And they can handle it. You know, it's like if they're hurting, that doesn't mean you're hurting. It's just like, you just hold them and you support them in their own suffering as opposed to like, oh my God, they're suffering. What do I need to do to take it away from them? Let them have their suffering. It's okay. Yeah. It's suffering. And there's no emotion out there that's not okay. Like just let them live their lives.
I do have one quick little story that one of my IFS mentors had said in a training or supervision or something, but it really helps to put it in the physical of how parents are naturally these days can be with their kids suffering when they're, you know, that he was saying it's very much like a kid who's running really fast and they fall down. Mm-hmm. And if you're able to be right next to them, they really just want to tell you the story of the falling down, you know, and then I was running really fast and I got pushed out and then I had this thing on my knee and then you're like, oh yeah, okay, that sounds hard. You were running really fast. You just sort of repeat it back to them and you just hold space for them. Like within minutes, they are fucking over it and they are running back on the playground. It is literally that simple with their emotions too. They come back and somebody was mean to them. You know, I have to get my part. That's like, well, did you punch them? You know, that's my first, like, you know, I'd be like, I'm going to get that kid. Of course I get that one to step back, but August will just relate a hard experience. That sounds hard. That you just hold space and do something that simple takes when you grow up with a neglectful childhood, can be $40,000 of therapy to get.
Oh right gosh.
Here, you know? Yeah.
And just to add on this, so I was having a text conversation with a friend of mine who is an awesome mom. And she had posted a meme about holding space for your kids' feelings, you know, and I just said, you know, this isn't really like the parenting that I personally experienced, you know. And she said about herself that she wasn't allowed to have or express her own feelings because it would be selfish and upsetting.
I can't tell you how much I hear that in people, you know, working through people's childhoods. The other piece, parents just be happy. You remember we talked about this, the ice cream approach.
Let's go
get some ice cream.
Yes.
You're okay. And it's like, it's fine. Literally, they can go into the depths of sorrow, hold space, and they'll be right back, you know, or whatever it is, or just trust, right?
And it's like, and just... They know how to do this. Just back off. Yeah. They know how to do this. You're not in charge here. It's a dialogue between you and them.
But I do think they need to see you do it as well. You know, I wonder sometimes with August, he has not witnessed us entirely. I go from zero to like rage about mom stuff or whatever, her needs that are coming up, you know, and I'm like, I'm handing him some of my trauma, some of the family lineage of trauma. Don't be afraid to pass some of that on too.
That's true. I don't think that you can.
You just have to show him how you do it.
Don't be afraid. You're better off making mistakes with confidence than you are being ambivalent and uncertain when it comes to parenting.
Yeah.
Like you just trust yourself and just do what you feel is right. I mean, do your work, pay attention to your own feelings, pay attention to your kids' feelings, like take it seriously, but you gotta, you know, like trust the system, trust that your love and trust their love and trust evolution is kind of my whole key.
Yeah. And repair. Don't be afraid to repair and say, you're right. I fucked up. That was weird.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much, Tom.
Well, thank you. It's fun.
So good to see you. Yeah.
Good to see you.
We'll have to have you on again soon for double husband and wife therapy hour.
There we go.
It's so fun to talk to you both, since you both have such a good, clear understanding on, so have done so much work.
Yeah. Oh, my favorite phrase is, I'm the most expensive car I've ever driven. I'm like a fucking Tesla at this point. Yeah. Let's go.